Hi, I'm Jenny Salt. While we wait for the beginning of season 5, I thought I'd share with you some of my favorite episodes from the Salt Vault. We've had some wonderful stories over the years, but these are among our greatest treasures. Last week, I shared Ruth Meyer's story. This week, it's Richard, Reflections on Life in the Shadow of Death. This was a wonderful conversation with Richard Hibbert, hearing about his life and ministry in places such as Turkey and Bulgaria. And to meet Richard is to come into contact with someone with a true passion for life, for people, for adventure, and most of all, for God. Richard also shared his reflections on life in the context of death. He talked candidly about the reality of dying. He was diagnosed with cancer a few years before. And surprisingly, Richard likened it to another adventure. This conversation is even more precious because Richard went home to be with the Lord not long after this episode was recorded.
The Eternity Podcast Network. eternitypodcasts.com.au.
Hello, I'm Jenny Salt, and welcome to Salt, a place where we'll enter into the lives of people and discover heartwarming, sometimes challenging, yet always distinctive gospel stories.
We used to take trips on buses, on old communist buses, leftover buses, to other towns. We'd take a trip a week with little baby in arms. And you'd go to a place and then you'd say, where are the God people? And then they'd lead you to the God people, and the God person would lead you to the leader or the pastor or whatever, or his wife, and get to know them. And it was completely, I don't know, it was an adventure.
My guest today is Richard Hibbert. Over the years, Richard has been a missionary, church planter. He is an author of many publications, mostly in the area of cross-cultural ministry, and is also a senior lecturer in missions at Sydney Missionary and Bible College. Which may sound a little conservative, but it might surprise you to learn Richard is also someone who loves adventure. Welcome, Richard. It's so lovely to have you here. Richard, you're married to Evelyn and you have two adult children, and I want to hear more about your family in a minute. But first, you began your career, your working life as a doctor. Tell us about that.
Goodness me, that was a long time ago. Well, doctors have to go through medical school, so that's what happened. Went through medical school. I met my wife.
So that was a positive from all of that.
That was a positive.
Yes.
I actually came to faith in Jesus through medical school as well.
Oh, did you? Yes. So that's another positive.
Yes.
But was it your lifelong dream to be a doctor?
No. I had all my family on my mother's side, just about, except for my mum herself, are doctors. Every single one. Great uncles, great aunts, grandmother, grandfather, the list goes on. So there was great pressure on me. I wanted to be an electronics engineer.
So why didn't you become an electronics engineer?
Because I had a very persuasive grandmother. So eventually somehow I got it into my head that did I want to do it? Anyway, it was what you had to do. It's right. That kind of a family. So, we finished medicine and went on, this is now with my wife, Evelyn, to our intern year, which was our only year of practicing as doctors.
And for Evelyn as well, so you went through back then 5 years of uni,
yep.
1 year of internship, and then you would become a resident,
yep.
And that's when your medical career would pretty much start.
Yep.
So for you and Evelyn, you did the minimum.
Yep.
And then you stopped.
We did.
Now, why is that?
Why is that? Well, the coming to know the Lord was pretty important. That was first year. And everything changed. Everything changed. Discovering in the beginning of second year that he's the boss. Mm. What he says goes. So then I started looking. Then I discovered the Great Commission. Oh, my goodness. All nations. maybe I'm supposed to be doing this making of disciples somewhere else. I mean, it suddenly opened it up from Australia to the possibility of elsewhere. And then beginning to read through a book called Operation World that talks about all the needs of different countries across the world. And Turkey really hit me, really got to me. It says it back in 1980, whatever that was, 1984 edition, I think it says, it's the largest unevangelized nation in the world. At that point, it said, okay, that's a big enough challenge, Lord. I'm going to head in that direction. Stop me if I'm completely on the wrong track. Then I went around that time I met Evelyn.
And you're in second year of uni at that point, is that right?
This is now actually, well, that second year of uni was discovering the Great Commission. Third year of uni was where and also finding.
Turkey.
Well, and also Evelyn, who wasn't as, well, who for 2 years I thought was very, very strange. And then things changed, and she was interested in the Kurdish people, half of whom live in Turkey.
Aha. Uh-huh. So what did your family think about you being part of a family of doctors, becoming a Christian, and then pretty much abandoning ship?
Yes, very good question. My mum said, over my dead body, are you going to Turkey?
I hope that wasn't the case.
It wasn't the case.
No, good.
Thankfully.
In terms of her dead body, I mean.
Yes, no, yes. Thankfully it wasn't. So we pressed on and she actually eventually came to a personal faith in the Lord as well.
That's wonderful.
She kind of worked it out why we. She tried to stop me. Tried to stop me.
How did she try and stop you?
Well, she thought that the best way would be to read the Bible and to convinced me from the Bible that it wasn't the right thing. So there you go.
But she failed in that.
She did fail.
But she became a Christian. Mm. And in the end, was she happy for you and Evelyn to go to Turkey?
I don't think. No, it wasn't. It was after. It was 5 years after we had started.
Oh, I see.
On that
okay.
journey that,
right.
that her mind got changed.
Yes.
Was she ever completely happy? I don't know about that.
Because Turkey, let's think about Turkey. So you finished off doing your medical training,
yes.
including internship.
Yep.
How soon after that did you and Evelyn go to Turkey?
So we had that year, and then we had a year of Bible college, and then we had a few months of candidates orientation, and then on the final day of the candidates orientation course, we left, sold our little Gemini and used that to pay for tickets and left.
And off you went.
1989.
To Turkey.
Yep.
Do you remember your first impressions of Turkey?
Yes.
The sights and the sounds.
Yes, I'm afraid so. People had arranged for us to stay in this little flat unit or whatever you call it for a few months. And it was overlooking the Cumartesi Pazarı, which means the Saturday market of this whole area, which is a massive event that goes all out onto the street, really, really noisy. And we're a few meters away from it. And we arrived on a Saturday. So it was overwhelming. Yeah.
And so you were there for how long, Richard?
That was 3.5 years in Turkey, living in Istanbul and doing lots of traveling out.
And when you look back on those 3.5 years, what do you look back on?
I look back on lots and lots of journeys to meet people who'd never met a follower of Jesus before in their lives, some of whom were very scared, some of whom were very interested, some of whom just wanted to get out of the country or marry someone who wasn't Turkish, but some people who started walking on the Jesus road, some people who extraordinarily God was working in to draw them to himself, which is really, really extraordinary. These are people who I was the only believer that they knew for those early years, and then I tried to bring them back and bring them back to Istanbul, get them to come on a bus and meet some other believers. So yeah, the extraordinary thing of God at work in what looks like impossible situations.
And you and Evelyn were working together, going out and speaking to people.
Generally, it was just me because it was a guy kind of thing. The guys sort of go out and do the outy stuff and meet with other guys, and women more meet with other women.
And so Evelyn was doing that with women?
Yes.
And was it a kind of a church planting type of ministry?
This is kind of pre-church planting. Mm. This is places where there is no church. These are towns and cities along the Black Sea coast, which I was more responsible for, that had no church. So, yes, it's the very first people encountering Christianity for the first time.
Amazing. 3.5 years in Turkey.
Yep.
And then why change? Why not stay longer than 3.5 years?
Oh, man, we're really digging deep here. Okay, so I became more and more tired. I was doing long, long trips and these are 18-hour bus rides along the Black Sea coast. And I got physically tired. I got emotionally tired. I got somehow also spiritually, I can't explain it. Something was going on. And I even got a letter from home saying, stop, rest, revive, survive. Remember those things?
Yes.
When you
drive longer than 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So
why did someone send that to you?
Because they could tell from what we were writing or whatever. In those days it was still, you know, you write on paper and send a letter and all that, that something wasn't quite right. And so we thought, okay. Actually, I didn't take any notice of that. I kept going and I got more and more exhausted. And finally Evelyn said, right, you've got to stop. So it's okay, you've got to stop. So what now? And then someone said, hey, we think we can plant a church in southern Bulgaria among Turkish people in a week, which just is impossible. But and we just need some people to follow up the new belief. People we believe will come to faith for the first few months. And I thought, okay, change is as good as rest. And off we went to Bulgaria.
And how would you describe the country of Bulgaria at that time?
It was a very interesting time to be there. I remember the man who took us across the border. You had to sort of do it in little hops with taxis. And the guy was going, Svoboda, Svoboda, everything is Svoboden, which is free. It's free. It's all free. What is it? It's immediately post-communism.
Ah.
And so it's like everything's freedom, freedom. And there was a kind of an openness or a freedom in the spiritual realm. So it seems, at least. People were hungry for anything and everything. I remember being in the marketplace and giving out, I don't know, some leaflet or brochure or something, and people would, they'd be thronging in, flocking in to get them, whatever it was. They didn't know what it was going to be. So it was a very interesting time to be there, very spiritually green, lots of people open to anything, including those who we came to know best, the Turkish gypsies, the Millet people, who were hungry to hear about a saviour who loved them.
You describe yourself as quite an adventurer.
Yes.
So does this living in Turkey and having a young family and then moving to Bulgaria, does that appeal to your sense of adventure?
Absolutely. I mean, if I had my druthers, I wouldn't be here. But the Lord knows. Definitely. I am a bit of a risk taker and an adventurer. And I like things that are on the edge and situations where you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm, which is so unlike me. I like to know what's going to happen. But you like,
don't
you
I
enjoy
know it? Yes.
The unknown and you enjoy the things that you can't control.
I do.
And so is that how your ministry was in Bulgaria?
There was no flight plan. There was no pre-planned pathway. Some of the things I enjoyed most in Bulgaria were the unexpected. We used to take trips on buses, on old communist buses, leftover buses, to other towns. We'd take a trip a week with little babe in arms. Well, I mean, babe, one-year-old in arms.
Ümit.
And Ümit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you'd go to a place and you'd find out where the neighborhood was of Turkish gypsies. And then you'd say, where are the God people? And then they'd lead you to the God people, and the God person would lead you to the leader or the pastor or whatever, or his wife, and get to know them. And it was completely, I don't know, it was an adventure.
Is Evelyn also an adventure?
No, no, no. Please have plans and please make it.
And yet she was willing to go with you.
Yeah?
Yes. And then after, 9 years being in Bulgaria, you decided to leave Bulgaria.
We did. We got our arms got twisted. Mm. Finally, I think by God, the agency we were with wanted us to do some more helping of other teams in other places, which we said no to initially for a good length of time until we felt we were getting some whispers from God about it.
Mm. So you left Bulgaria and came back to Australia. Is that where the arms that were twisting your arm were?
No, they were in England. So we were in the UK for 3 years, but doing lots of travelling out to lots of different countries.
But then eventually you did come back to Australia.
Eventually we came back to Australia. We tried to go somewhere else. We tried to take our kids to South Korea, and we were there for 3 weeks.
South Korea?
Yeah, and they were teenagers, or at least Amit was by then, and they said to us, "Dad, Mum, if you want to be in South Korea, that's just great, but we're going to be in Australia." So I realised
so they twisted your arms.
A breaking point.
Yes. And so you came to Australia, and what was the next adventure for you as a family?
Oh, goodness. The next adventure was thinking about how to revamp the pre-field training of missionaries so it's more practical and hands-on and on the job. And which is what we did, and so rather than having people sort of in a more classroom environment, out on the in homes and meeting people, and so that was quite an adventure.
So in terms of missionary work or cross-cultural ministry, if you're not on the field, you are wanting to prepare people to go out on the field. What would you prefer?
Oh, I'd definitely like to be out there.
Yeah. Yep. And yet, for the last, how long have you been at SMBC?
Ten long years.
Long years.
There are many times I can remember walking through that back gate and saying to the Lord, "What am I doing here?"
Really?
And pretty much getting an answer, like his reassurance immediately. "This is where I want you for now. This is just calm down, basically."
Because I think SMBC loves Richard Hibbert being there.
Well, that's lovely.
But anyway.
So I can say it's the God.
Yes. And what's your...
And cancer.
And cancer.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Well, so about 8 years ago, speaking about adventures in life.
Yes.
There was a change, another adventure about
there
to begin.
There was a change.
What happened then?
I was on a long, long bushwalk. We were getting our bushwalks at the weekends were getting longer and longer, and we'd just done an 11-hour one.
And you love bushwalks.
I love
you?
Bushwalks.
In fact, you've driven a co-bushwalker to
delirium through lack of water and heat.
Not deliberately, I take it.
Not deliberate. It. No.
But that's part of your adventurous nature that you like to push yourself.
Yes.
And
yes.
Anyone else with you?
Yes, that's
okay.
Right. So this was Evelyn and me, and it was quite a bit of a cross-country thing, and we got lost, and there was some falling down sort of. Anyway, we weren't going into the details. Anyway, the last 2 hours of it was me limping and thinking, "Well, I've done something to my leg." And then months going by, and then finally getting some x-rays and all that kind of stuff.
So you're seeing physios and...
I've seen podiatrist, physio.
Just to see what was happening with your knee.
Yes.
And then you had an x-ray.
And then finally, the x-ray we better not talk about, but the MRI finally found out, there's a great big tumour there. And...
On the end of your femur, going into your knee.
Yep. Yep, so chemotherapy and surgery and radiotherapy and all that kind of adventure.
And what was the initial diagnosis?
Does anyone hearing this know
Give us some fancy titles.
Undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma.
Okay.
Okay, that'll mean a lot to most people.
But basically bone cancer.
You got it. Yeah.
And that was 8 years ago.
Yep.
And what was the prognosis at that point?
They're not nice. If they'd managed to get it all at that point, Not too bad, that they do often recur locally. But they didn't get it all, and it had broken out of the bone. It was pretty big tumour. So there was every likelihood it would come back, but no one knew. Maybe chemotherapy and radiotherapy had killed all those little cells. But by 2014, it became clear that it had spread into my lungs.
Right. Okay. Now that's pretty serious.
Sounds serious, doesn't it? I remember talking to Pierre saying, well, Pierre, I don't think I'll be here in 2 years' time. Because I'm thinking, okay, it spread.
Yes. Bad. Into the lungs. So Pierre being one of your fellow lecturers at SNBC.
Yes.
And so it went to your lungs. So what does that mean?
It means cut them out. This kind of cancer, we don't enjoy being cut out, but that's the best way to get rid of it,
right.
Really. So lots and lots of operations. Lots. There are four different. Open up the ribs,
chest cavity.
Get your hand in there and find them and cut them out.
And they did numerous surgeries for that.
Yep.
But there must be a limit to how much.
There is a limit.
You can take out.
I've got about 50% of my lungs left over.
Okay.
Which is enough. It's okay. But there's a limit.
And that's so that's the minimum.
Well, the surgeon says I'm not going to do any more. You'll be too breathless.
Okay.
So the most recent thing I had was knitting needles. Which is burning things out on the ends of knitting needles. You still have to get them in there.
Okay, on your lungs.
On the lungs.
Okay.
And then really since then, things seem to have stopped.
That's about 4 years ago. And it stopped.
Well, the most recent was 2017.
Okay, we had the knitting needles into
knitting
the
needles
lungs.
Was 2018.
And has it spread? Has the cancer spread anywhere else or is it just pretty much
yes,
lungs?
Yes, it has.
Yes. Okay.
So this year we found out that there are some other ones, other secondaries in nasty places. You don't want them to be there. Things like liver and kidney and pancreas and stuff like that.
So you were officially diagnosed with stage 4 cancer right when you had your knee surgery.
Yes.
What does stage 4 cancer mean?
So when it was just in the knee, that's actually, because it was a large tumour, that's stage 3. So you have stage 1 is like a small thing, stage 2 is bigger, stage 3 is a bigger tumour still. But stage 4 means it's spread across into other areas of the body, in this case lung.
And does that mean that is it curable or incurable? How do doctors view that? How do you doctors view that?
It depends what kind of cancer it is, but with sarcoma, it is not good. Sarcoma is nasty. Sorry for those who have sarcoma. But it's not very good. They are getting better at doing all kinds of things, but surgery still remains the most effective way of getting rid of it. But you run out of body. Yes, you run out of body.
Richard, when you talk about your cancer, you're actually very lighthearted.
Yes.
You speak about it in a surprising way because a lot of people will speak with subdued tones and use words that kind of soften the blow or just steer around it. And yet you are very happy to talk about it.
Yes.
And you speak about it with almost a sense of lightheartedness, as I said, almost joy. Is that a fair comment? How do you view your cancer?
Well, maybe it's part of the adventure. I have got used to it. I've had lots of time to get used to it. But it's part of the adventure and knowing whose I am. Everyone who belongs to Jesus is in extremely safe hands. And it's not, you can't not smile about the idea of being with him face to face. Can you? I don't know. Maybe you can, but that's glorious. So I think that God has given me the gift of joy, I suppose, in this. Maybe it's partly because I like adventure and you never know what's going to happen next. But I think more than that, I think it's the security of knowing I'm in his hands.
So when you think about dying, and after you die?
Yes.
What do you think about?
I think about I want to live well, meaning to please him, and I want to die well in a way that pleases him. And that is a little bit scary. It's like the process when you're feeling sick or feeling in pain, it's a lot easier to be quite grumpy. So anyway, I'm hoping that that process will, he's the potter, we're the clay. So he's constantly molding and making us. And I want that part as well to be one in which I can be molded and can be made and can be formed, continue to get to know him better. The glorious thing is we're looking forward to the other side.
How do you see the other side?
Well, it's pretty vague. I don't have the details, but it's being with him and all his people forever. And it's like, I think of it as an enormous hotel with all these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of rooms. And it's like, okay, I'd just like to have some time with whoever it is in room 180021. I'm sure it won't be a big hotel, but you think, like, how do you can... You keep coming across these people who've had an amazing life and now ongoing life with the Lord. So I think about those people and the ones who I know who are there with the Lord. And the Lord himself is like, oh my goodness, that all the riches of wisdom and knowledge and his glory and his unfailing love, all right there with you. It's extraordinary.
Mm, yeah. It's amazing. And you say you want to die well, but you want to live well.
Yes.
And in fact, you and Evelyn have been prolific in the last 12 to 18 months, perhaps longer, of writing. You have been churning out the books.
Yep.
Why? Yes. Is that part of living well and dying well?
I think we have probably sped up a little bit, thinking that the time might be short that we could write together. But at the same time, we've got some things that we really want to say, and it's not about saying so much, it's about we can think of groups of people who we might be able to help, a small number of people we might be able to help. So our first book was on leading multicultural teams, and we really feel for those who are trying to do that. It's a tough job. So I think the books we write are about trying to help people with the ministries they have.
Richard, your take on death and dying and having stage 4 cancer is probably quite unusual, and there could be people listening who are either facing the prospect of dying or can't imagine having anything but dread of dying. Mm. What would you say to someone like that?
It is scary. When I first found I had secondaries in my lungs, I thought, oh my goodness. I thought, what about me? Like, basically, what's going to happen? What's the process ahead? And how am I going to go with that process? And the scary process of becoming ill and the unknown, really.
And pain?
The unknown and pain.
Yeah.
I hadn't really got to the really super pain parts that by then. Yeah, they have wonderful things like opiates and wonderful drugs. Praise God. So there is that. That's the first time. And then more recently, even last year when things sort of hit home again, I thought, oh, my goodness, family, how are they going to go? So that the sadness of separation for them, it's kind of easy for the person. It's easier, I think, for the person dying than it is for the people left behind. So I'd processing through that, it certainly took a while. For me, though, I think I've come to the point where I see death as a stepping stone. It's not that life won't continue. Life will continue. So it's a continuation of life on the other side. And if you happen to know Jesus, then you know you're being welcomed by him, into his arms. And that's a wonderful security. Yeah.
How does Evelyn feel, and what about the rest of the family when Umit and Aidan and Izette? You've got a granddaughter who loves you very much.
Yes.
I take it she's a bit of a she loves. What does she call you?
She calls me Dede.
Dede,
which means grandfather.
And she loves her Dede.
She does. We saw her this morning, which was great fun.
And she loves spending time with you. How do they deal with the fact that you have stage four?
Well, Izette's too small. She's one and a half, so I think she'd be very advanced to have an understanding, I think, of that. The other's stable. What can I say? Evelyn's extremely rock-like and stable, so more than I am, which is wonderful. And for children, I think that, look, we've had lots of time to come to terms with this. But each bit of new news, especially if it's not such good news, as it were, it does take a bit of getting used to. It will take a few days. So I think we'll just have to see.
And as an adventurer, but as one who knows the Lord Jesus, when you look back over your life, what stands out?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think I got prepared for this one. What stands out looking back over my life? The burden that God's given me, it isn't so much about looking back, it's looking forward more. And that is the people who've never had the opportunity to hear about Jesus. So the unreached peoples, that's my lifelong burden, as in burden, thing that God's given me to sort of live into and live out of. I can't explain it fully, but it's like a virus you can't get rid of. So that propels me forward, doing what I can to help those people hear about him.
Richard, it is so encouraging hearing your story and hearing about your adventures. And I thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed being part of the conversation with Richard today, and importantly, been encouraged to be salt to those around you. In the next episode, I'll be talking to Darlene Evans, someone who communicates the gospel to people who are incapable of hearing it. I hope to see you then.